Hey, I'm Chris.
What's up? I'm Mars.
Last time, we laid the groundwork for acute appendicitis, covering incidence, pathophysiology, classic presentation, and the initial diagnostic workup. Today, we're diving deep into the differential diagnosis, the gnarly complications, and the game plan for treatment. This is where you really earn your stripes for the shelf, so let's get it.
You got that right, Chris. Rule number one of appendicitis, or really any abdominal pain, is to always maintain a broad differential diagnosis. Why? Because no single symptom or lab test rules it in or out, and there are tons of conditions that can mimic it.
So Mars, for our listeners gearing up for the shelf, what are the top contenders that can throw a wrench in the diagnosis, especially in different patient populations?
The mimics are plentiful. In females of childbearing age, it's mission critical to rule out gynecologic causes like pelvic inflammatory disease or PID, ovarian torsion, ruptured or hemorrhagic ovarian cysts, and the big one, ectopic pregnancy. Pro tip, a urine pregnancy test is always a must in these patients.
Good call. And don't sleep on GI causes either. Gastroenteritis is a common imposter. Here's a high-yield pearl. In appendicitis, pain usually comes before nausea and vomiting. With gastroenteritis, it's flipped. Nausea and vomiting come first, then the pain.
Exactly. And don't forget Meckel's diverticulitis, which can present identically to appendicitis. A Meckel's diverticulum is a congenital remnant of the Vitelline duct, and it's the most common congenital anomaly of the GI tract. It's found in about 2% of the population, often in children under 2, and can become inflamed, just like an appendix. Another big one in kids is mesenteric lymphadenitis, often caused by Yersinia enterocolitica. It can mimic appendicitis so closely, it's nicknamed pseudo-appendicitis.
And what about urinary system? A urinalysis might show sterile pyuria, white blood cells in the urine without bacteria, if the inflamed appendix is irritating the ureter or bladder. This can totally throw you off and make you think UTI.
Right. And for male patients, don't forget to check for testicular torsion. It can present with referred right lower quadrant pain. A testicular exam is crucial to avoid missing this surgical emergency.
Another big mimic is Crohn's disease, especially when it involves the terminal ileum or cecum. Because of the transmural inflammation, it can cause right lower quadrant pain and mimic appendicitis perfectly.
That's key. Now let's talk intra-op findings. What if the appendix looks normal?
In most cases, if you find a normal appendix during an appendectomy, you should still remove it to prevent future diagnostic confusion. But there's one big exception. If you find Crohn's disease involving the cecum, don't remove the appendix. The stump may not heal, and you can develop infection or a fecal fistula. Also, avoid biopsy in this situation.
And let's hit on appendiceal tumors. Shelf gold right here. The most common appendiceal tumor is a carcinoid tumor. It can actually cause appendicitis by blocking the lumen. Small carcinoid tumors less than 1 to 1.5 centimeters at the tip of the appendix, or simple appendectomy is enough. Larger tumors, greater than 2 centimeters or any tumor at the base, require a right hemicolectomy for clear margins and lymph node evaluation. And appendiceal adenocarcinoma, which is more aggressive, also requires a right hemicolectomy regardless of size.
All right, let's shift to treatment. Mars, what's the deal with pain control before surgery?
No more old school myths. Pain management should always be a priority. Giving opioids, NSAIDs, or acetaminophen doesn't delay diagnosis or mess with scoring systems like Alvarado. Ease their suffering.
Preach. Now let's talk antibiotics. Almost everyone diagnosed with appendicitis gets antibiotics, often even before surgery.
For uncomplicated acute appendicitis, antibiotics alone can be considered in select patients. But heads up, 40% of these patients will need surgery within a year due to recurrence.
Wow. Let's cover some of the common antibiotics you may use for appendicitis. We usually cover colonic flora, gram-negative aerobes, and anaerobes. Here's what you'll see. So first up, cefoxitin, also known as mifoxin. It works by inhibiting bacterial cell wall synthesis. Most patients tolerate it well, but watch out for GI upset and the occasional allergy reaction. Next, we've got ampicillin sulbactin, or Unicin. This one's a broad-spectrum penicillin combined with a beta-lactamase inhibitor. It's great for mixed infections, but side effects can include rash and diarrhea. ciprofloxacin and metronidazole are usually used in combination. Ciprofloxacin, or cipro, inhibits bacterial DNA gyrase, but you have to warn patients about rare but serious side effects like tendon rupture and QT prolongation. Then there's metronidazole, aka Flagyl. It's your go-to for anaerobes and works by disrupting DNA synthesis. Fun fact, well, not so fun for patients, it can leave them with a metallic taste in their mouth and can also cause a disulfiram-like reaction if the patient drinks alcohol. This means they can feel nauseated and flush.
And for the more complicated cases, say perforation or abscess, you'll often see Zosyn or even a carbapenem like meropenem brought in for broad spectrum coverage.
And how long do we keep them on antibiotics?
For non-perforated cases, stop within 24 hours post-op. If there's perforation or abscess, continue until they're afebrile, WBC normalizes, and GI function returns, usually 3 to 7 days.
Let's talk surgery. Appendectomy is still the gold standard. While it's considered urgent, it's not a drop-everything emergency in the first 24 to 48 hours. But once you decide to operate, don't delay.
And laparoscopic appendectomy is preferred over open because of lower wound infection rates, fewer complications, shorter stays, and faster return to activity. Plus, laparoscopy lets you inspect the peritoneal cavity if the diagnosis isn't clear.
And if there's a perforated appendix with a localized abscess,
then percutaneous drainage with IV antibiotics is often the move. It can result in lower morbidity and mortality than immediate surgery. An interval appendectomy 6 to 12 months later is sometimes done, but recent studies suggest it's not always necessary.
All right, team, let's hit you with the top high-yield facts before we bounce. 1. A broad differential is critical for acute abdominal pain. Many conditions mimic appendicitis. 2. In females of childbearing age, always check a urine pregnancy test to rule out ectopic pregnancy. 3. Mesenteric lymphadenitis, pseudoappendicitis, is a key mimic in kids, often caused by Yersinia enterocolitica.
And 4. Perforated appendicitis increases risks of sepsis and fetal loss in pregnancy. Don't miss it. And 5, laparoscopic appendectomy is generally preferred due to fewer complications. And here's 5 more for your memory bank. 6, pain management doesn't mask symptoms or delay diagnosis. Give analgesia early. 7, sterile pyuria on UA may reflect an irritated ureter or bladder, not always a UTI. 8, Crohn's disease involving the cecum, don't remove the appendix. Risk of fecal fistula. 9. Carcinoid tumors less than 1 to 1.5 centimeters at the tip of the appendix are simple appendectomies enough. And 10. For perforated appendicitis with an abscess, percutaneous drainage plus antibiotics is often first line.
All right, team. Keep studying. We'll see you next time here on Surgery Shelf Prep.
Peace out.